This farce, this 20th century Bastille that pretends to be a pocket democracy. Why don't you put us all into solitary confinement until you get what you're after and have done with it?
That's enough! I call this meeting to order!
Look at them. Brainwashed imbeciles. Can you laugh? Can you cry? Can you think? Is this what they did to you? Is this how they tried to break you till they got what they were after? In your heads must still be the remnant of a brain. In your hearts must still be the desire to be a human being again.
This is a most serious breach of etiquette. I'd imagine your desire to stand for election was genuine.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Two massive anniversaries about the conflict at the heart of the world. Why so little analysis by the press of the roots of the Middle East conflict? Yes, 50 years since the Six-Day War, which was based on a lie that Israel was being attacked. And illegally, they then trebled the size of the Israeli state. And 100 years since the original secret Balfour Declaration, which promised Zionists a homeland in the British Empire. Yes, why so little analysis of what's become an open wound in the Middle East with religious fundamentalism, Zionist, more important, many say, than Muslim, at the heart of it? Tonight we hear about abuses of the Old Testament Bible, Moses, Exodus 3,500 years ago by Zionist fundamentalists to justify apartheid and land grabs from the author of a book, Christian Zionism, Roadmap to Armageddon. He's a Church of England vicar, Stephen Sizer. In a February 2016 media furore, he was asked by the Bishop of Guildford to give up his rights to speak publicly about the Middle East. Imagine that, if you're a vicar. And he wasn't allowed to use social media. We find out tonight he wasn't actually banned, as the newspaper said he was, in his first interview about the furore since he retired from his parish in Surrey earlier this year. Plus, Mad Dog Mattis is at it again. In 2004, he was caught using white phosphorus chemical weapons on civilians in the Iraqi city of Fallujah. Last week, according to the UN and Human Rights Watch, the US Air Force is using this devastating and illegal chemical weapon again against civilians in Iraq and also in Raqqa, Syria. But before all that, I'm joined by Christine Townsend, a former teacher and campaigner around education, to take a look around some of our secondary schools for people thinking about maybe where their children are going to go next year. Anyway, Christine, can you just give us an idea of where education is at in the city now? Because maybe 10 years ago, there were massive criticisms, national criticisms, about particularly about secondary education in Bristol.
Well, what's happened in the last decade is pretty much every secondary school in our city has become an academy. We only have two secondaries that are now not academised, and about 50% of our primary schools are now academies.
So what does it mean when a school becomes an academy? We're sitting in one now.
Yeah, absolutely. It means that they're answerable, in inverted commas, to the Department of Education and not the local authority for some of their areas. But what has happened in Bristol, in my opinion, is that locally elected councillors, because of their lack of understanding and expertise, have washed their hands of actually holding to account what's happening, particularly at secondary level. There are many levers that do remain at a local level that our elected sort of representatives need to be using so that there is better engagement with our schools as a system.
So do councillors actually have any control still if this is all being managed by central government?
Well, the local authority is responsible for the safeguarding of all children, and that's regardless of what type of school they go to, including the independent sector. And if you can't safeguard children, then you can't educate them. All children with special educational needs are locally accountable to our elected representatives. The local authority is also responsible for making sure there's enough places for children to go to school, and by that I mean that there are as many places as there are children that exist that need schools. They're also responsible for making sure that academies can find sites. So there are lots of areas where the local authority is still highly involved, and those where they are wholly responsible.
Now, do you think the councillors and the local authority generally are actually doing their job in making sure that these slightly arm's length schools now are actually educating our kids the way they should be?
Well, I take the view that they aren't doing that, and we've had, well, we're on our 10th investigation now into secondary schools in Bristol around unlawful practice when it comes to the way that they
allocate their places. I mean, surely schools have always been being investigated since before the academy era too.
But the local authority has the legal responsibility to do the to report the school for investigation, and they have not been doing it because I have.
Well, how do you mean? So you're flagging up issues and the local authority are supposed to investigate them, but they're not?
They're supposed to report them for investigation, and they're simply not doing it. What the officers would prefer to do, because they also want to sell these academy services, is to have quiet words in their offices and go and speak to their head.
Okay, hang on a minute, because that means effectively by flagging up an issue and saying that they're not doing this, and this is either illegal or unlawful or potentially just against government guidance, rather than actually disciplining them for not doing that, they're going and actually having a quiet word and saying, well, people are saying that you're not doing this, maybe you better change it, which doesn't actually, is no incentive for them to actually keep to the guidance, keep to the law in the first place in that case.
Well, I completely agree, and there are local authorities not so far away that do report their academies to be investigated. Bristol just chooses not to do it.
So in what way are those people who are running those academies close to the city council and the mayor and the you know, senior officers?
Well, a couple of the schools that have been investigated, one being St Mary Redcliffe, St Bede's, St Bernadette's, they are church schools, so they've got the power of those huge institutions behind them. The other schools that have been investigated, Colston Girls have been done, Merchants Academy have been done. They're both merchant venture linked. The Bristol Cathedral Choir School is linked to both the church and the merchant venturers. So what we're talking about are kind of city, you know, those that have been around and running schools in the city, and I would suggest having lots of political influence for not only decades but, you know, hundreds of years.
Yeah, certainly centuries, really. I mean, 1497 is when Cabot sailed out of Bristol with a bit of money from the Bardi Bank over in Italy to so-called discover America. Well, he didn't really discover it, did he? It was really a kind of reconnaissance mission to colonise America. The merchant venturers, once they realised what they had there with that massive continent, and then they formed the Society of Merchant Venturers a generation or so afterwards. But these people are still very, very wealthy. How wealthy are they?
Well, we don't know, because they don't open their books, do they? We're not allowed, we as members of the public aren't able to see where the merchant venturers invest their money, what assets they hold, or where you know, where they hold shares, things like that. For me it's very concerning that we don't know where that organisation gets and makes its money from, and yet they're running our schools.
So what do we know about them?
Well, we know that they run our schools and that they admit children in an unlawful manner.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Okay, so the Colston Girls, for example, had various ways in which they were making their arrangements very, very complicated, so that parents were confused, if you like, and they were told in no uncertain terms when they were investigated that they had to make it a lot clearer. Merchants Academy were wanting to test children outside of the lawfully allowed boundaries when it came to dates. The other thing that Merchants Academy has done is they've completely removed their catchment area, so they're no longer responsible for educating the children that did live in the previous area of what was Withywood when it was the school that they took over. So there's an area of South Bristol now where children are growing up where they don't live in the catchment area of a secondary school. It's the only area of the city where that is the case.
Well, I suppose people will say, well, we don't really care at the end of the day. It's the quality of the education.
Well, they got 24% A to C's last year, which is the lowest since the Merchants Academy came into existence, and I mean, the lowest in the city.
Surely they'll say, well, you know, these are kids from a poorer area.
Well, previous to that, the results were going up. And one of the reasons why the merchants were wanting to take over that particular school in the south is so that they could improve the standard of education there.
Now, I'm sure you have chit-chats with the staff that work at these places. Do you think that the staff, the teachers, are happy working there?
I would imagine that some of them would be, but Nick Short, who took over last year as the secondary head, didn't last the year, so he's finishing at the end of this year. Now, this man is younger than I am. He's been teaching for less years than I have. He was the head teacher of the school for less than a year. I mean, that says something really about, you know, the kind of pressure that man was under, or how he felt about being the head.
Because I know there are actually quite a lot of complaints, not necessarily to do with academy schools, by teachers at the moment. I mean, for one thing, that their pay generally is not keeping anywhere near close to the cost of living.
Well, public sector pay has gone at 1%, hasn't it, under the austerity agenda from the since 2010. So like nurses and like all public sector workers, the value of what teachers are paid has gone down since 2010.
Also, I mean, you know, certainly I've done some investigative journalism on the merchant ventures over the years. I think we really do need to know much more about them in order to have confidence that, for example, that their money that they're making as an organisation is coming from ethical sources, that it's not being, for example, it's not in places like Switzerland, tax havens, this kind of thing. I mean, you could imagine actually that they could have vast amounts of money in Switzerland when no one would even know about it, because the amazing thing is, because they're constituted under a royal charter, they don't even have to file accounts.
Well, and you know, that's one of the reasons why I would like to see them open their books. And I think that it's time that they did that, because they're not only involved in running public schools, are they? State-funded schools. They're all individuals are involved in running the hospitals. They run the university. You know, they sit on the zoo. They sit on the Downs Committee. These people are involved
Bristol Water.
Exactly.
We had the previous master on this program talking about what it was like to run Bristol Water. I mean, I've had a bit of a debacle with them personally in Bristol Water, and not only that, the national regulator has said that they are the worst company in the country. They're overcharging their customers more than anyone else, and rather than eat humble pie, Bristol Water then decided to take out some legal action against Ofwat to try and say, well, we are charging the right amount. They're basically doing these big infrastructure projects which Ofwat say are totally unnecessary, and told them that they had to reduce their bills by 30%, which they then didn't do. So these are the kinds of people we're dealing with here. What's the latest on the merchants? What have you and your colleagues found out about, you know, what we do know about them?
Well, I'm currently doing a bit of casework down with the Merchants Academy, so I can't really talk about that particular case because it's not come to kind of fulfilment and fruition as yet. But the other thing that's going on is a school that's associated with another big academy provider, if you like, which is also ongoing, and I'm waiting on the adjudicator to make a ruling on that particular school as to whether how they're admitting students is also lawful. They're just across the border in South Gloucestershire, and that ruling is imminent. I mean, it could be any day when that's published. So that's another school that is allocating their places in an unlawful manner.
Well, what about Bristol Radical History Group? I don't know if you're in touch with them, but I mean, they seem to have been digging out all sorts of interesting things recently about the merchants, including the connections between it was thought for a long time that the merchants were kind of separate to Colston, but actually it's the same families involved.
Well, yes, I mean, there's been quite a lot of research that the history group have been doing around Edward Colston, and it's new research, isn't it? And there's been a lot of suppression around Edward Colston in this city because it's the merchant venturers that want to push this person forward as this Bristolian son. And You know, they want their schools to celebrate this man, and the cathedral are up to their waist in enabling them to do that.
Well, let's see what the new bishop does, because the old one's taken a walk after we exposed him as telling the all these school children, hundreds of school children, that the life of Edward Colston and his business dealings and referring obliquely to the slave trade was speculation. Of course, it's not speculation. He did make most of his money through slave trading and other things as well. But do you think there's any prospect of celebrating some of the people that helped abolish the slave trade in the city?
Since the Colston Hall has sort of announced that it's going to change its name, various people have come forward and given names. On a personal level, I think that human beings, what they are, I think it's difficult to name something after an individual. I think it'd be better to have something like the Bristol Hall. So it's a bit more generic, and there's no possibility that in 10 or 15 years' time, or some other historian that doesn't like the particular the idea that the Colston Hall is going to change its name, goes around and digs up some dirt on whoever it is that the hall is named after.
Also, I suppose the long run really is, do you think Bristol's education has been turned around? 10 years ago we were hearing it was some of the worst in the country.
The buildings have absolutely turned themselves around. What I do think we are beginning to see, though, is the impact of the education cuts. So the recent Ofsted reports that have come out in the primary sector, there's been four primary schools in the last 3 months that have come out as inadequate. And the problem when you cut funding is that those schools that educate children from most disadvantaged backgrounds, what they can provide will go downhill very quickly, and I think we're beginning to see that. I'm interested to see what Ofsted are going to make of the 24% that the Merchants Academy's got last year. Maybe this summer the results will go back up and it was a blip year, as they might call it. But if there becomes a pattern of low achievement at the Merchants Academy, then Ofsted need to be going in there and seeing why that has gone downhill.
I mean, we're talking about two subjects tonight, really, which is the history in Colston, as well as the schools and the links between the merchants and some of these academies. But where is one of the best places to follow some of this online, Christine?
I'm on Twitter under my own name. You'll be able to find me under there. But the Office of the School Adjudicator is where all the rulings are published. So there will be a local school coming up there very shortly, so people can go onto that website and they can read those reports. But they can also read the reports of every other school in Bristol that's been investigated and see what it is that these schools were doing that were unlawful.
And I suppose finally is the cuts, because we're even hearing that parents are being told they've got to please cough up, please do a direct debit or a standing order to help your school.
Yeah, Redland Green sent a letter home to all parents about 2 months ago asking them basically to do that, set up some direct debits. Stoke Bishop, which is a primary school up in the north, they've announced that they've had to cut 10 members of staff. My own school that I'm a governor at, which is Whitehall, we did our budget very recently. We've just about managed to keep our staffing levels at the same level. But next year, if things don't change, I cannot see what else can be cut. And every school is pretty much in that position.
Well, that's sad news, especially since we seem to have managed to turn education around. Now, the government pulling out the rug from underneath people.
Absolutely, and it's happening at a national level, isn't it? And this was a huge issue during the election campaign. There were protests up and down the country. Bristol had a city centre protest, the largest that happened. We had five sort of community meetings, if you like, raising awareness, because it's appeared, certainly the Tories didn't want to talk about the cuts that were coming down the line when it came to our schools, but also Labour were a bit slow on the take-up as well, because that sort of national protest was led by the Head Teachers Union, which is the first time in my career, which has been, I've been around for 20 years in the teaching profession, I've never seen Head Teachers Union speak out in the way that they did, and they still continue to do it because the cuts are still there. The announcements around our funding have not changed.
Well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll put a link to your Twitter feed, and I'll also put a link to the Head Teachers Union on
our, absolutely, the NAHT, National Association of Head Teachers. And the other thing that's happened in Bristol of late is that the secretary, the local secretary, has become much more active. Is Jamie Barry. He's the head of Parson Street Primary School in Bedminster, and he and Kezia Featherstone, who is the head of the Bridge down in South Bristol, they are two head teachers that are really on the case, and they have a really, they understand the city and they understand what the implications are, and neither of those head teachers are kind of being led on or afraid to speak out, and it needs to be heads that speak out.
Christine Townsend, thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show.
Thank you.
Representing the entire city, this is BCFM 93.2.
Now, Martin, we've got a bit of a problem, haven't we, with Mad Dog Mattis over in Iraq and in Syria. Human Rights Watch and the UN saying he's using white phosphorus again. What is this stuff?
Well, I mean, it's basically used on battlefields to create, supposed to be to create smoke. But, of course, if you fire it directly at people, it's like napalm. It burns them. And it's...
Napalm.
Yeah. So that's why
I know you,
it's regarded as nasty.
You were telling
stuff.
Me just before we came on air that you knew somebody that actually experienced an attack by white phosphorus.
She's a Palestinian friend of mine, Dima. I've forgotten her second name, but she was in Beirut in 1982 when the Israelis invaded Lebanon, kills 30,000 civilians. She was in a shelter in a Palestinian refugee camp in Beirut, and a white phosphorus bomb hit the entrance to the shelter and started set people on fire, basically. And of course, as people writhed around on fire, they passed this this flame across the shelter, and she was on the far side of the shelter, and she could see all these people dying as it came towards her, but it burned itself out before it got to her.
Well, the humanitarian groups, what they're saying is that white phosphorus is a particularly horrific type of chemical weapon because it actually uses human bodies as fuel to sort of burn.
Well, that's right. Once people start burning, they become torches, and then they touch other people, and then they get burned as well. Yeah.
So it's in the Iraqi...
So it's like the body fat of the people becomes the... I mean, I think that's probably true of fires in general.
Used last week, apparently, according to Human Rights Watch and the UN, by the US in the Iraqi city of Mosul and in the Syrian city of Raqqa.
Well, there's lots of civilians being killed by NATO and its allies in this region. And, of course, there was a lot of hoo-ha not long ago about the Russians killing civilians with their airstrikes. I'm afraid airstrikes do kill civilians. But, of course, the Russians, whatever they're doing, they're accused of being heartless murderers, etc. But when we do it, and it is us that's doing it, then it's just unfortunate and we can't do anything about it.
Well, the New Zealand Brigadier General Hugh McAslan admitted that the potentially lethal substance, the Independent tells us, had been used as they attempted to free civilians trapped in neighbourhoods controlled by ISIS. He said around 28,000 civilians managed to travel out of ISIS strongholds in the city over the last few days. But, of course, this is actually illegal to use this stuff in any kind of anywhere where civilians may be.
Well, that may be so, and if you think about all the fuss about the Syrian army supposedly using chemical weapons at Idlib and at Ghouta, there is a massive double standard here. But if we take a step back, you've got to realise that all war is incredibly destructive, and we shouldn't have started this war in the first place in 2003. It's still not over. There's probably a long way to go and a lot more people to die.
What's the point of it all, though, Martin?
Well, it's all about usual things of geopolitical struggles for power, influence, money, greed, all the stuff that most wars are usually about.
Well, what specifically?
Well, I mean, the creation of ISIS by the Gulf powers, particularly Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and I find it really hilarious, in one level, that the Saudis are accusing the Qataris of supporting terrorism in Syria, when in actual fact, all the evidence shows that both Qatar and and Saudi have been the main funders and supporters of ISIS and similar groups inside Syria. And of course, so have we. British Special Forces, as we speak, are at Al Tanf with the American Special Forces and Norwegian Special Forces. They're not supposed to be there. It's illegal. And in order to protect these Special Forces, the NATO aircraft have been attacking Syrian government forces. And the Syrian government have recently managed to fight their way through to the border with Iraq and link up with the Iraqi forces, who are supposedly our allies fighting ISIS. And they've been attacked by the Americans supporting British Special Forces to try and prevent them. But what that means, of course, is that they are now sealed off. They're in a sealed pocket. And and the Russians have made it absolutely clear, any attempt by the Western-backed rebels in that pocket, or British Special Forces, or anybody else to try and break out of that pocket, will lead to full-on confrontation.
Well, isn't this inevitably going to lead to some sort of fight with the Russians?
It probably is. What's happened with Trump is that he has basically handed over policy in the region to his military. And Mattis, of course, was forced on him, and McMaster have been forced on him. He wanted to have Flynn, but Flynn's been removed. So what Trump's now doing is he's just basically said to his military, well, you decide. But I think the Russians have already made it clear to the US military that if they carry on down the road they're going, there will be a full-on confrontation. And, of course, they'll lose. There must be at maximum 200 special forces in there. The Russian Air Force and the Syrian Army, Hezbollah, etc., will just crucify them if it comes to a fight.
Let's talk about Turkey for a minute, because I noticed that they have brought on the Russian missile systems. They're part of NATO, and yet they're using Russian S-300 air defence missiles.
Well, I didn't know the Turks had done that, so that's news to me. What is interesting is the Turks are rushing a battalion of troops to Qatar in order to deter the Saudis. And what's happening is that the alliance that came together between the Turks and the Qataris, who are aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood, the Saudis and others who are not, in order to try and overthrow Assad, who is still the democratically elected leader of Syria. He won the election overwhelmingly when it was held in 2012. They're now falling apart, fighting each other. And of course, they're accused. What's hilarious to my mind is that the Saudis are accusing the Qataris of supporting ISIS, and of course, the Qataris just point the finger back at the Saudis and say, "But you support ISIS." And of course, the fact is that Saudi, Qatar, and the NATO powers, including Britain, we created ISIS.
Now, Qatar,
of course, everybody in the Syrian army knows.
Qatar is the base for CENTCOM, which is the part of these big American organisations like EUCOM, CENTCOM, AFRICOM that are projecting US power all over the world, including into places like China and Russia, supposedly.
That's right, that's right. But that possibly means that the situation won't get out of hand because you've got that big US military base there. So if there's any fighting, they're going to be caught up in it. But there's a real potential for Saudi Arabia to invade Qatar here. They invaded Bahrain, they invaded Yemen. The regime's very unstable, run by quite loopy people. Every bit as loopy as Kim Jong-un. And the hot oil price is slipping, they're losing their control.
There's been hacking of and criticism of Al Jazeera, because this is one thing that does set Qatar apart as the base in Doha for the Al Jazeera channel, which, for example, on the Ukraine conflict, I mean, it's not very good on a lot of subjects, but on Ukraine it was really the only balanced media you were getting almost anywhere in the world.
Well, I think what I'd say about Al Jazeera is that they were trying to compete with Russia Today, BBC, etc., on providing a relatively unbiased... Obviously, they're funded by the government of Qatar. They're not going to be too critical of their own government. But nevertheless, for example, they were the only media channel in the Middle East that regularly had on Israeli spokespeople justifying Israel's position on various things.
Yeah, and supporting Palestinians, for example. But, yeah. I mean,
but
there was
they brought the Israelis on to give their position. You know, in Saudi Arabia, which is an ally of Israel, Israelis aren't allowed to come on TV in Saudi Arabia to justify their position. Nobody justifies their position. Saudi TV is just controlled completely by the government.
It was also, amazingly, putting all of the British media to shame, that as they did back in January, Al Jazeera, by doing a sting operation against the Israeli embassy and the political attaché Shai Massot, who, amongst one of the things that he said quietly while he was being secretly recorded, was that there is £1 million slush fund in order to influence the Labour Party in order to get pro pro-Zionist people higher up in the Labour Party and to take out people who are pro-Palestinian in the Labour Party.
Well, including people in the... they were also talking in that secretly filmed conversation about getting rid of a Tory government minister they didn't like. Now, of course, we keep going... There's a load of confected nonsense going on about did the Russians hack the French election or whatever. Meanwhile, we've got overwhelming evidence that the Israelis are spending money hand over fist, and of course it's US taxpayer money if you think about it, because they haven't got any money of their own. It's a client state in order to try and influence British politics.
Also, we're hearing today that the Senate has voted for new sanctions on Iran and Russia. Germany and Austria criticising the US sanctions against Russia. Putin, Russia wants constructive dialogue with the United States, but they're not getting it, are they?
No, and of course the Austrians and the Germans are basically partners on building a gas pipeline, the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, which will come under the Baltic Sea from Siberia and deliver gas directly to Germany. It's an absolutely logical economic thing to do, makes perfect sense. But of course the Americans are very unhappy, because that means that they basically will be, eventually the economic ties will squeeze them out.
Anyway, it's 50 years since the Six-Day War, which was based on a lie. Great article, actually, on the Intercept website about that. I'll put a link up to that on our show page, exactly why the Six-Day War was based on a lie. That Israel was being attacked and illegally trebled the size of the Israeli state back in 1967. And it's 100 years since the original secret Balfour Declaration, which promised Zionists a homeland in the British Empire. Yes, hardly any analysis of what's become an open wound in the Middle East with religious fundamentalism, Zionism, many argue, rather than Muslim, at the heart of it. Tonight we hear about abuses of the Old Testament Bible, Moses' Exodus 3,500 years ago, by Zionist fundamentalists to justify apartheid and land grabs. We're going to hear now from the author of Christian Zionism, Roadmap to Armageddon. He's a former Church of England vicar, just retired, and his name is Stephen Sizer.
Well, my name is Stephen Sizer. I'm a retired minister of the Church of England, and I've been involved with Christian, Jewish and Muslim groups in the Middle East for about 20 years. I took out pilgrimage groups for a number of years, and it was through engaging with Jewish groups as well as Palestinian groups, I realized that the main line or mainstream script which we see and hear in our newspapers and on the TV screens is largely driven by an American or Israeli agenda, and that tends to polarize people's views into the good guys and the bad guys. Arabs typically are bad, Muslims are bad, and Israel can do no wrong. And then when you add the religious dimension, typically Christians believe that somehow what's happening in Israel, Palestine today is God's will and fulfillment of Bible prophecy. When you add all those things together, it's a really volatile cocktail. And I did some study on it. I read a couple of books. I got into trouble with the Israel lobby. But I've continued to go back and try and understand and try and be a bridge builder or an advocate for Palestinian groups, particularly who feel marginalized and ignored, and be a voice for them in the West and in Britain in particular.
Now, those books, I know there's one called Christian Zionism, another one called The Roadmap to Armageddon, which is quite a provocative title. Am I right in thinking that the publishers, that they're not available through the publishers anymore?
Well, there were two books. Christian Zionism, Roadmap to Armageddon was my PhD thesis, which came out in 2004. That, quite a heavy book, 400 pages. The publishers didn't expect it to sell more than a few hundred copies. It actually sold several thousand. Got published in the States in Arabic, Farsi, and parts of it in Chinese and Korean. But it needs updating. It was my PhD thesis over 10 years, published in 2004, so I was working on it for the 10 years prior to that. So it's rather out of date, so I'm not surprised that they felt it needed to be revised before they reprint it or publish it. Second book, Zion's Christian Soldiers, is more timeless, shorter, punchier, looking at how the Bible has been used and abused by various groups to justify what's happening in the Middle East. And I published that, I think, around 2008. So again, it's nearly 10 years old and it needs updating.
Christian Zionism, actually, we don't hear very much about it at all on the mainstream press. What is it?
Well, Zionism is a word that describes a particular political philosophy that came about in about the 70s, 1880s, the word was coined as a movement aspiring to create a state for the Jews in the Middle East. You know, at the time when Jews were suffering in Eastern Europe, they were marginalized, persecuted. There was a lot of anti-Semitism.
Was the focus of the Zionists right from the start on Jerusalem?
No. If I can go back and answer your question about Christian Zionism, Zionism was a political theory or a conviction that the Jews wanted to have their own independent state. And clearly, Jerusalem was central to that. But the land itself, they went back to the time of Abraham and the promise God made to Abraham, your land, or, you know, from the river of Egypt to the Euphrates. And that at the time was part of the Ottoman Empire. And as the empire declined and Britain and France took over, the Zionist movement saw Britain as a potential ally in realizing their vision, their dream. So Christian Zionism came about, again, about the 1870s, 1880s, as a religious movement born out of the conviction that God wanted the Jews to be back in the land as a Christian nation. Well, as the Jews came back to the land, they didn't come back as Christians, and it certainly wasn't a Christian nation. And so progressively, Christian Zionism modified itself to the view that the Jews must be encouraged to come back to the land, and then they will come to the Messiah later. So today, probably 9 out of every 10 Zionists are Christians, particularly in the States, 60, 70 million at least, people who identify themselves as pro-Zionist out of their Christian convictions. Jerusalem is central to Zionism, clearly, because at the moment it's still a divided city. There are no embassies in Jerusalem. They're all in Tel Aviv, because the international community recognizes Tel Aviv as the capital of Israel. Israel wants to have Jerusalem as its capital because it will consolidate its claim to the West Bank, as well as that part of the land which is regarded as the state of Israel today.
So, June in 2017, it is exactly 50 years since the Six-Day War, which was fought while people were bopping in Britain to the Beatles and things like that. We weren't necessarily concentrating on the Middle East, but it was to have pretty enormous consequences for the years to come, wasn't it?
Very definitely. From an Israeli point of view, they saw themselves as a beleaguered state surrounded by Arab states that denied their right to exist. From an Israeli point of view, they were attacked and they fought back, and in their victory took land which had previously been part of Egypt and Gaza, part of Jordan in the West Bank, and parts of Syria, which was the Golan. From the Arab point of view, they would regard Israel as having preemptively struck. I mean, they destroyed the Egyptian Air Force on the ground, for example. They saw Israel as the aggressor because they were taking land that was not theirs, and the West Bank in particular had always been part of the aspiration for the Jewish state. I mean, under international law, where there is regrettably a war between nations, at the end of that war, irrespective of who was the belligerent, land has to be returned to the sovereign state to which it belonged before the war. So under international law, Israel's annexation of East Jerusalem, its occupation of Gaza, the Golan Heights and the West Bank is entirely illegal under international law.
But the Israelis will say, won't they, that there's a higher law here, and that's God's law.
Well, when we start to bandy about the Bible to justify one side, inevitably we're very selective in our use of scripture. There is plenty in the Old Testament prophets that emphasize the importance of sharing the land when they returned out of exile with the people living in the land. So I would say, as a theologian, there is much more grounds theologically and biblically for a shared one-state solution than a two-state. And certainly it's untenable to claim promises from, say, God's promises made to Abraham and apply them today and ignore the ethical requirements which the prophets laid down upon God's people when they returned to the land, about who they shared it with and how they regarded it as God's land.
The Israelis now would say, well, we are sharing the land.
Well, they're not, because the land, if we're talking about the occupied territories, they have settled it with several hundred thousand Israeli Jews, and they've denied fundamental basic rights of the Palestinians who live there. They don't have the right to vote. They don't have the right to represent themselves. It is an ongoing occupation which has been condemned repeatedly by the United Nations and Europe, the UK, Russia, the US, EU have all subscribed to a two-state solution where Israel must withdraw from the West Bank and allow a sovereign, independent Palestinian state, two states side by side. That's what the international community regards as a just resolution of going back 100 years to the Balfour Declaration, 1917, and the War of 1967.
What do you think the significance is of the Six-Day War today?
Well, it was 50 years, which means it's the longest-running conflict that's still continuing, the longest-running dispute in the hands of the United Nations. I mean, Israel-Palestine is the subject of more UN resolutions than any other issue. So its significance is that it's an open wound and one whereby Israelis and Palestinians are suffering, and it has repercussions both for Syria in the Golan Heights, for the Lebanon, for Egypt, for Jordan. They're all suffering as a consequence of a failure to resolve the conflict.
What about the US role in all of this? Because the US were the first to recognise the State of Israel, and also we've got a new President Trump.
Israel was recognised by the President of the United States against the advice of his ambassadors in the Middle East and certainly against the advice of the UN. But the Zionist lobby got to him, and, you know, the State of Israel was recognised and came into existence through a UN resolution, which is very unusual. The rest of the world caved in because the US was the superpower. In international law, Israel is recognised as a sovereign state, but within the pre-1967 borders. But the US continues to play a very partisan role in the conflict. Various presidents have made noises about the settlements, for example, or sharing Jerusalem, but have continued to fund the settlement program, continued to fund Israel's war machine, and treat it kind of like a spoilt child, along with Saudi Arabia, its twin. And that's why Israel has no incentive to compromise or come to a resolution Palestinians.
What do you make of Trump and his first few months in office?
Well, I don't have a lot of respect for Donald Trump as an individual, given his track record in terms of casinos, in terms of his business dealings, and his rather authoritarian approach to decision-making. How long he survives as a president is debatable. But at the end of the day, I mean, we can say good and bad things about President Putin in Russia, Donald Trump, even Theresa May. What matters is on what basis decisions are made. Are they based on the rule of international law or on the basis of power brokers and individuals who wield great influence, whether it's through their money or through their armies? The world has suffered a great deal from dictators and the like. And, you know, I and colleagues are calling for the implementation of international law and the recognition of the role of the United Nations in resolving conflicts such as that between Israel and Palestine.
When he was campaigning, Trump said he wanted to see the capital of Israel shifted from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Now he seems to have reined back on that.
He's not the first, and that's because the reality is the Zionist lobby wants to create Jerusalem as its capital, and the various sessions of Congress have passed the legislation to do that. They have identified the location, the funding is there, but every president since 1967 has refused to sign off on the legislation. And so what Donald Trump might have said when he was electioneering is very different from what he's willing to do now as president. He's clearly taking advice from his State Department, who are advising him strongly against recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel because of the impact it will have militarily in the Middle East, as well as on the US's standing in the Middle East too.
the whole idea of moving the capital to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv is one of your points on your roadmap to Armageddon, that you've pointed out that there are various things which the Israeli state has wanted over the years, some of which they've got, some of which they still want. Can you just run us through that point by point? You know, what is it that is this? I mean, it sounds like an awful way to end up Armageddon, but it does seem that if you've got religious fundamentalists that believe this war is inevitable, then they believe that there probably will be these steps on the way to get there.
Well, if you think in terms of three concentric rings, the outside one is the land, and if you go back 100 years, the Balfour Declaration, the promise made by the British government to the Zionist movement was that we would allow a Jewish presence in the British Empire. We would not create a state, but we'd give them a homeland, because if you remember, in 1917, Britain was the world superpower, and we weren't giving anyone anything for free. We were blessing them with membership of the British Empire. And that's, I think, what Balfour understood he was promising the Jews. They saw it very differently. They thought that Israel was going to bequeath to them both sides of the River Jordan and reconstitute, if you like, the borders of the Kingdom of David and Solomon. That wasn't going to be, because we'd already agreed with the French we were going to split Syria and Lebanon off and give that to the French, and Britain was going to keep what became Israel, Palestine, Jordan and Iraq within our empires. But as our empire waned, and as we got beaten up and shot at by both sides, Arabs and Jews, when they realized we weren't going to give them what we'd promised them, we got out and left it to them to fight over in the war of 1948. But if the outside ring is the land, the second ring is Jerusalem, and the third ring is the temple. Israel is largely a secular state, but within Israel and also within the wider Jewish community, alongside the Christian Zionist community, is a strong religious conviction that the temple must be rebuilt. So you have these three concentric circles: the land, Jerusalem, and the temple. So Jerusalem itself might be the goal of the secular Zionists, but the temple is the key for those who have religious convictions. So the existence of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock sitting on the Haram al-Sharif, or the Temple Mount, is regarded as anathema, an abomination to both Zionists and Christian Zionists. There have been various attempts to destroy it, and others pray daily that the temple will be rebuilt. Only then will Israel, as a religious as well as political state, be complete. But how they get there, if they get there, and the consequences are really terrifying when you consider the nuclear, chemical and biological weapons that exist in an area that is about the size of Wales.
Is it possible for Judaism and Jewish temple and the Islam to coexist on that site?
Well, you have to ask the Jews and the Muslims. From a Christian perspective, land is not that important. And although we have some very fine Christian buildings, we worship at an empty tomb. We don't regard any bit of real estate as sacred or holy or to be fought over or died for. So from a Christian perspective, there is no need for a temple. It's a retrograde step from a Christian perspective, because we have a temple, that's Jesus. We have a high priest, that's Jesus. But whether, well, they share it now. The Western Wall is the place where Jews pray, and the Haram al-Sharif is where the Muslims pray. So they pray right next to each other on a daily basis. So coexistence is possible. But if the expectation is that the Dome of the Rock's got to be destroyed and a temple built next to it, you're asking for the impossible, and it will ignite a conflict between Muslims worldwide. It is the third holiest shrine within Islam. And we're not just talking about the Arabs in the Middle East, the Muslims in the Middle East. We're talking about Muslims in Southeast Asia, Britain, America, and virtually every country. So it would be a provocative act. Now, attempts are made every year to do that. There is a group called the Temple Mount Faithful, who in July, on the day when they remember the destruction of the temple, attempt to relay the cornerstones for the new temple, and the police who control the Temple Mount refuse them access. So attempts are being made all the time to take that territory. They could have done it in 67, ironically, but at that time they chose not to.
Now, you have had a few scrapes with the Church of England, despite being a vicar. Could you explain what your position is now? Because they told you, I think, not that you weren't allowed to use social media. And it must be very difficult for a vicar who's told he's not allowed to talk about the Middle East.
Well, I haven't really talked about this publicly, but if I could just correct you on that, Anglican clergy are free to express opinions on any subject, and unless one commits a criminal act, one is not restricted in how one interprets one's ministry. So the reality is I voluntarily agreed to give up using social media for a short period of time to help diffuse a situation where quite a powerful lobby in the UK was targeting me, along with other Anglican clergy and others, and putting pressure on the church to discipline me and others. The reality was I voluntarily agreed to give up using social media at the request of my bishop for a period of time, and I'm now free as an Anglican clergyman to continue to do so.
So if people want to buy your books, obviously, you know, those are available. Maybe you could just remind us of the titles or follow your work. Are you blogging? And how would they do that?
Well, if you type my name, Stephen Sizer, you'll find me on the internet. My website is stephensizer.com. I'm now director of a Christian charity called Peacemaker Mediators, and the website is peacemakers.ngo. We're committed to peacemaking, and our focus is wherever minorities are persecuted, where justice is denied, where human rights are suppressed, reconciliation is needed. So we're a Christian charity, registered charity, and I'm working in a number of countries, particularly in the Middle East, where Christians are having a hard time. And that's the focus of my ministry now. But folk listening are very welcome to check out my website and find details of my books. Most of what I've said and written is freely available online at no cost.
Just remind us of the titles of the books again, Stephen.
Christian Zionism Roadmap to Armageddon is published by IVP, and that was a look at historical roots, theological basis, and political consequences of Christian Zionism, which is the dominant form of Zionism in the world. And the second book was called Zion's Christian Soldiers, the Bible, Israel, and the Church, and that looks in more detail at how the Bible has been abused, misused, misquoted, and attempts to explain in simple terms how the Bible should be read, and as a consequence of that, diffuse the situation in Israel-Palestine today.
That's the retired Reverend Stephen Sizer. Now, Martin, he was ticked off early last year for posting a link, a Facebook link, to an article saying 9/11, Israel did it, all the truth, all the proof in the world.
Yes, he was. And of course, 9/11 is the big elephant in the room. We were talking about the fire in Kensington earlier. And of course, one thing that didn't happen is the building didn't collapse. And there's been loads of fires in similar buildings all over the world since 9/11, and none of them have collapsed. On 9/11, three tall buildings collapsed, supposedly through fire. But of course, if it was a fire that brought down the three buildings, you'd have thought people have changed the fire regulations all over the world, that have closed down loads of high-rise buildings, etc. But of course, in actual fact, the buildings were bombed, as Donald Trump pointed out on the day, and as Nils Harriet and Steve Jones of the University of Utah and the University of Copenhagen have shown in scientific papers that they've had reviewed by peers. And you know, it's pretty clear that the buildings were bombed.
People have been pointing out, Martin, flames were engulfing the Grenfell Tower for nearly 24 hours, whereas when flames engulfed the very top sections of the New York's high-rise tower, the Twin Towers, it was only an hour and 42 minutes before they collapsed.
Apart from WTC7, the third building, which collapsed at 5:30 some hours later, but if you look at the video of it, it doesn't seem to be on fire at all. All three buildings were bombed. That's pretty clear. The Russian general staff know that. General Ivashov was just commander of the Russian general staff on the day. People can look his stuff up.
Also, Emmanuel Macron's party remains on course for a historic landslide win, and it's a brand new party out of nowhere.
Yeah, with a very, very low turnout, I think you'll see. There was a big turnout in the presidential elections, and lots of people have just stayed home. We'll have to see how he rules.
Also, Jeff Sessions this week, Donald Trump's Attorney General, was grilled over his links to Russia, and he has said he's actually saying that this attack is appalling and detestable lies, false and scurrilous attacks against him. Some people are even saying that this is a little bit like a kind of McCarthyite witch hunt, kind of Arthur Miller and this sort of witch hunt.
Well, I think it is, but what's really bizarre about it, it's the liberal press in the US which is trying to run a Russian mole hunt. And of course it was the liberals like Arthur Miller who resisted this kind of thing back in the 50s.
So also,
a bit of a change of pace there.
Also a shooting in Virginia, congressman being shot at, hardly injured, but the shooter is killed.
Yeah, well, the shooter was supposedly a Bernie Sanders nutcase supporter. Bernie Sanders has already sort of said he condemns it. There may be a strategy of tension going on here, where various nutters go around blowing things up and shooting people from both sides of the political spectrum.
And what's
just
the point?
Keep everybody on edge and more power to the deep state.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7, coming up live on Facebook, and Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi and Yusuf, the Ramadan edition. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, leader of the Conservative Group on Bristol City Council, councillor for Henbury and Brentree, that's Mark Weston, also Labour councillor for Eastville, Vary Threlfall, and also, of course, you just heard there, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, and Stephen Sizer, the long interview just now. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon every Tuesday. This show's story links and comment pages, one word, thisweek.org.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. He's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us on the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.